Wait a minute. No, this isn't my day off. I have a podcast to record. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Cannon Fodder Podcast. I'm Daniel Barnes, film critic at large, and just large film critic, you know, just large, living large, large in size, large in heart, large in spirit. And you know who's large and in charge? It's my man, Corky McDonald. What's up, Corky?
He's large.
He's large. It's true.
Thank you for singing backup. You know, Shelley, Robert Altman's best movie.
Shelley was singing just for me. You thought she was singing for Brutus, but no, he's large.
I'm doing great, Dan. I'm glad to hear that you're large and in charge. I'm large and in charge.
You're in charge. I'm just large.
You're just large.
Yeah, large and subservient. So.
But you do use your credit card enough a lot, so you are charging things.
I have the large amount of credit debt. Yeah, absolutely. So I guess I'm large and large in charge.
Not yeah, large actually, and Dan, in this charge. This whole podcast has just been a ruse to talk to you about your credit card debt. Sorry, it's a credit card intervention here.
Thank God. Speaking of interventions, Corky, I think that I have finally. Certain of this, I have finally decided on the spot for our annual Cannon Fodder retreat. Unless I'm not feeling it, and then I just leave.
You just don't bring it up.
That's it. Here's your key. Bye. Oh, that's quality stuff.
Where is it? Where?
Oh no, that was sorry. That was just a bit. I was doing Delphine from the film that we'll be reviewing today, The Green Ray. Just wanted to get you used to obnoxious behavior right away.
Oh yeah. Speaking of obnoxious behavior, I'd like to obsequiously and just grotesquely genuflect in front of the heroes. I call them titans. We're going, you know, old Greek myth style on this. Yeah. They are the gods of this earth. They are the PayPal supporters and donors to the show. Without them, this show would not exist. Dan and I would just stop being large and in charge. We would shut down. We would.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, the podcast would cease to exist. I'm afraid that you and I might cease to exist. I think we may just vanish off the face of the earth if our donors stop donating to the show, honestly.
Because, so thank you for keeping the show going. Thank you for keeping Dan and I's purpose on this earth going.
I didn't realize that you and I were a Charlie Kaufman premise. We are.
We are?
Okay, we're extremely meta. Okay.
I feel like you should have known that. In keeping with the Charlie Kaufman notes of it. Thank you to everybody who donates to the show and keeps us going with the lights on.
And if you'd like to donate to the show, just go over to DearDaniel.com. It's in the menu. It's there on the sidebar. You'll find it. Scroll down. It's there. Make a one-time donation, monthly donation. You can even make a yearly donation if you really plan that far ahead. Any contribution you make helps keep this show going and helps keep us existing here on this, you know, plane of consciousness. Otherwise, we may just be an idea on a podcast. We're not sure.
Today, we're discussing The Green Ray, the IMDb synopsis for The Green Ray. It's July, and Delphine has nowhere to go for the summer. She feels very bored and empty, but this won't last. One day, she accidentally meets someone who seems to be totally made for her.
Yes, this week's film, it's The Green Ray, a.k.a. Le Rayon Vert, that's the French title, co-written and directed by Eric Rohmer. He was a journalist and film critic, Rohmer was, before he turned to filmmaking. He was editor of Cahiers du Cinéma, that's where a lot of the French New Wave people came out of, but he kind of came a little later to the Cahiers du Cinéma than the Godard, Truffaut, Chabrol group, so he was a few years behind them getting started as a filmmaker. Ended up being probably the most prolific filmmaker of the bunch and the most sort of durable and consistent of that crowd, too. I mean, you think Truffaut died He was in his early 50s, I think, when he died. Godard turns to experimental filmmaking. Chabrol just kind of, you know, falls out of fashion. But there was always a small, loyal audience for Eric Rohmer, just like there was always a small, loyal audience for, like, Woody Allen or Richard Linklater. Didn't work on an epic scale. These are intimate films. The Rohmer film is talky, often circular, typically stories of young love, either thwarted or self-sabotaged, oftentimes set on a beach or at a resort or on vacation, like this film here. This is kind of a classic Rohmer setup here in The Green Ray. The stories are usually pretty simple, and yet the characters pretty complex. They're people who talk a lot, but talk sort of around things instead of about things. They can't really express their desires and feelings, even to themselves sometimes. We made a lot of movies that are linked as sort of a series, not by narrative, but by concept or by theme. His first six films were the moral tales, and those all treat the same central conundrum, the same central setup in six different ways. Also known for his Tales of the Four Seasons, one for each of the four seasons, and his sixth film, Comedies and Proverbs series, in which each film was inspired by a proverb. The Green Ray, that's the fifth film in the Comedies and Proverbs series. But like I said, it's not like if you haven't seen the first four that you're like, oh, what the hell is going on here? They're all kind of the same sort of simple setup. They're all based on a proverb. This one comes from a Rimbaud quote, the French poet. Oh, may the time come when hearts fall in love. The Green Ray was largely improvised. Lead actress Marie Raviere, she has a special co-screenplay credit, as was the style. Rohmer kind of, he brought the cast together to discuss the film, talk about their characters, and then each actor went and invented their own dialogue from there. He said Marie Raviere is the one who really called the shots. That's why she gets that sort of special credit. The film was shot chronologically in 16mm by cinematographer Sophie Maintignon, with Rohmer and his crew trying to be as inconspicuous as possible. He wanted an immediacy there, although with immediacy comes ordinary beachgoers just locking eyes with the camera, like just straight locking eyes with it. Tilda Swinton in Orlando looking at the camera kind of level. But there is, again, there is a real immediacy to it as well. The Green Ray, it was celebrated in its time. It won the Golden Lion and the Fipresky Prize. That's the International Critics Prize. At the 1986 Venice Film Festival, actually premiered in France on pay television, kind of groundbreaking in that way as well. Opened in America August 29, 1986. It was, again, praised upon its release. It did well, you know, as like I said, there's an audience, a small, loyal audience for Rohmer. And today it is tied for number 225 on the most recent Sight and Sound Critics Poll. That is the only Rohmer film to make the cut there of his several dozen feature films that he made. Quirky.
Yes, sir.
You and I, it seems like we can't always get on the same page with French movies. Uh-huh. If you remember Vagabond, I was on board. You didn't go for it. We had Godard with Parole le Fou. You were on board. I was off. Mm-hmm. I think Mouchette. There's another one. The Dreyer film made in France. Seems like we can't, like, one of us is on, one of us is off. There's aspects of French cinema that obviously we're responding to in different sort of ways. So please, please tell me. There's a green ray reaching out. The sun's setting. This is your last chance. Here it is. Are we on the same page with the green ray? Because I thought this was a marvelous film. I thought it was absolutely fantastic. What did you think?
Oh, we're definitely disagreeing on this one. Yeah,
no, nope. Green Ray, sunsets, end of the world.
No ray.
Sun exploded.
And I've already left watching the sunset. You can stay staring at that thing.
I'm still staring. Wait for that ray.
I actually got mad watching this movie.
Interesting.
Like, yeah, maybe I'm too much like Delphine, but you want to see a movie about going on vacation by yourself that feels like being on vacation by yourself, and it's this movie. Like, I get what it's doing. It's not hard. Like, I think it was a very well put by you that very simple storylines but complex characters, and that's that scene is repeated throughout this movie. Like that, getting that shown to you. So I didn't like this character. Maybe you're not supposed to, but okay, that worked.
Fair enough.
Manic depressive person is manic and depressed and repeat, rinse, repeat. So I just, it did so little for me. It's very neat looking. The places they go are fantastic, but there was a point in this movie where I was just like, I want her to go out in that water just to leave me the fuck alone so I could sit on this beach and just enjoy, you know, looking at the French countryside.
Yeah. Obviously, we saw the same movie and had similar views of the character, but I just think we had similar reactions to the film. I go back to Vagabond again, because again, sure. I think the crux of that, our disagreement there, was that you really disliked the character of Mona, yeah. Which again, I can't argue with you on it. You're saying like she's flawed in all these ways, and you want to say like Delphine is flawed in all these ways too. It's not the same film. You know what I mean?
No.
Like style wise or theme wise, or even like what we end up learning about Mona, which is the Sandrine Bonnaire character in Vagabond, and what we learn about Delphine, who is played by Marie Ravière here in The Green Ray. But I think like that was like a bridge that you could not cross, like was just how unlikable she was and how, I don't know, resistant to change or to redemption she was. I'm not exactly sure like what it was. Exactly. Again, I can't really disagree with you. Delphine is not really likable. Mm-hmm. She's not virtuous. She doesn't like, she's definitely spoiled. She's definitely yep. whiny. I'm not going to say that. I just think like, personally as a, maybe this is just me, but as a socially maladroit, emotionally irrational person myself.
Yeah.
You know, I recognized some things, and that's why I think this movie was funny to me, not because of bits. There's no bits, there's no jokes, there's no slapstick or anything like that. It's the humor of recognition, you know, it's the humor of just social fallibility and of being sort of like your worst version of yourself for everyone to see, right? She is this woman, Delphine. She is such a mess of
yeah.
contradictions, right? She is restless, utterly restless, and yet inert, right? She's emotionally overwhelmed and she's emotionally distant. She's the type who, if you offer her something, she'll refuse it. And if you don't offer it, she'll resent it, right? And I'm a flawed person myself. I recognized parts of myself, parts of other people in her, those parts of yourself that you aren't proud of and that you can't really explain, where you're like, why the fuck do I feel like this? Why am I acting like this? Why am I being this person? But that's like a very human thing to me. I think it's just how recognizably human this movie was and how funny it was in such a subtle sort of way. The humor comes from, again, behavior, but also from some of the edits that happen where it just jumps to a week later or it jumps to a different situation. And then the implications of that jump become like immediately obvious to you. And that's why I thought it was funny. But yeah, she's a mess. And this whole movie is basically about like something pretty simple, which is like, how do you spend this long, languorous Parisian vacation, right? Like, you know, the Europeans, they're all going to take like
2 months.
All this time, months off in the middle of the summer, and she's heading off. I mean, and like the thing is, like, yeah, you could be like, she's utterly spoiled because, yeah, who wouldn't want to be in her situation to be like, oh, I can't choose between going to the mountains, going to the coast, going to Ireland with my family,
going to Spain,
going to all of these like amazing places. And it's just like, she is just not happy anywhere she goes. You know, if she's at the beach, she wants to be in the mountains. She's at the mountains, she wants to be in the city. She's in the city, she wants to be anywhere else but the city, right? She's alone, she wants to be with people. She's with people, she feels even more alone. I get it. Like, it's really hard to tell what makes her tick because she's not I don't know. I feel like at that age, especially, we should say this character is probably mid 20s, probably.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd say that.
Yeah. And I think, like, at that age, especially, you're prone to that sort of weird feelings of restlessness. Like, I'm an adult. Mm-hmm. I'm self-sufficient. Like, she's a professional woman. She's out of school. She's moved on. She's had a relationship that has just ended. And so she's a little destabilized by that. She's destabilized even further by the first scene where her friend bails on what's going to be their Greek vacation. She's going to get out of town and do this thing. And she's not, as we see, really fully realized as a person. Like, again, she's a very deeply flawed. She's not fully mature. You know, she breaks down crying like over nothing.
Several times.
Many
over and
times.
Over.
Many, many times. And this is not, and this would be a different movie if she was buck-toothed and ugly and everyone was really mean to her. No one's mean to her. You know what I mean? Like, no one's really that mean. Like, even the guy who chases her down just, like, kind of is like, let's just hang out. I don't know anyone here. Like mm-hmm. I have nothing to do. Like, his friend is back there hitting on another woman. Like, what's he going to do for the rest of the night? You know what I mean? So it's like, no one's that mean. It's not a movie about, it's not, you know, this, like, high school movie about, like, the bullied girl who has to, like, you know, find herself, you know, like, she has everything. She's very beautiful. Like we say, she's successful. She has the means to go on any vacation seemingly that she wants to, but yeah, she's just a very, a difficult person to read. But I think unlike Vagabond, I think we do eventually, I think the first half in Vagabond, we never learn what makes Mona tick. We never learn who she really is or why she is who she is. Like, she seems to emerge tabula rasa from the sea. Whereas I think with Delphine in that second half, the first half is her, like, going to a place and then deciding, I don't want to be here, I'm leaving, and going back to Paris, and then going somewhere else, and then back to Paris. Somewhere else, this happens like 3 or 4 times where she's like, I'm going to go on vacation to this place. And then for whatever reason, she makes it weird and, like, leaves. The second half of the film is all set in Biarritz, pretty much. And I think that's the half where we actually do kind of, like, figure out what makes her tick. And again, this is, like, subtly. This is why I'm going to resist the idea that this is, like, rinse, repeat, every single scene is the same, and nothing is, like, added or revealed as the film goes on. Because I think there is a lot added and revealed. At first, she just seems like a whiny little brat, and as it goes on, it's kind of like, again, her feelings about men, about relationships. It's hard to explain, but she's obviously, like, very cold amongst, like, this whole dating scene. You know, it's anything insincere, she really runs from it, you know. But she, again, she's also such a socially awkward person. That whole scene with the meat eaters.
Yes, that to me, that typifies this movie.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, I get, maybe that's just like a, maybe that's like the Rubicon, because I think that scene is where I got on board with this and really figured out what it was trying to do. And then it sounds like this is where it may have broke you. So maybe describe the scene a little bit.
So this is someone who is eating at a vacation spot with a, she's tagged along with her friend to their family vacation spot. Lovely spot. Everybody's being lovely to her.
It's Cherbourg, the port city. That's the setting for the Jacques Demy film.
And everybody's being great to her, and they're just having, you know, casual conversation around eating, and she lets them know that she doesn't eat meat. And, like, they're agog at this.
Right. This is France, remember.
They're like, you don't eat meat. Like, they cannot comprehend. So they're quizzing her about it and different things. And this is where it's like, she tries to explain her rationale and does explain her rationale.
Yeah.
But it doesn't help. It's not like she does it comfortably or in a way that anybody's really going to get. Or when anybody tries to interject and understand, she shoots it down and tells them why that interpretation is wrong. And basically just fucks up the explanation. And
absolutely.
But not in, like, a Michael Scott cringe way where everybody's like, ugh. It's just, she's not a comfortable person in her own skin.
No, absolutely. And
That's this movie to me. Is that scene, is this movie, it doesn't, it, I get what it's doing. I get it. But it's not someone I want to eat dinner with.
No, I mean, fair enough. And neither do I. And I didn't. You know what I mean? Like, that's...
Well,
that's
I don't want to spend 90 minutes with them.
Well, okay. I mean, yeah, fair enough. Again, if that's just a bridge that can't be crossed. I mean, I would say it is sort of a Michael Scott cringe sort of way. It just doesn't have, like, comedy reactions.
But yeah, that's what I mean.
That's what it was for me. You know, but yeah, I didn't need the comedy reactions, is what I'm saying. She's explaining, like... Yeah, she's explaining why she doesn't eat meat in the worst possible way that you could, right? Like, it starts off, as you said, it starts off innocuous enough as just like, oh, it's seemingly like, oh, I don't like it, you know, oh, whatever, I'm just not into it or whatever like that. And then as she goes on, she's like, it's cruel and you don't care and you don't get it. Yeah. And it keeps happening and it keeps going and going and it goes along. After everyone else is done with it, and everyone's still like stuffing their faces with meat this entire time. But yeah, I think just that awkwardness and her not knowing, like, where do I stop? Like, where do I do that? I mean, to me, this is just, it was surprisingly funny. It was also surprisingly poignant as well, I thought. A portrait of loneliness, and you're never more lonely than when you're lonely on vacation.
On vacation, no,
in a big crowd of people, and 100%. That's what I think works for me about The Green Ray and about Romare in general. I think this is the cinema of Romare. It is like, as we said,
very Linklater.
There's absolutely huge influence, but, I got to think, on Linklater, on Nicole Holofcener, on that whole early Sundance generation to say, like, hey, this is possible. Like, you've had conversations with your friends. You've had, how to evoke emotions in a very subtle sort of way without needing, like, crowd shots and things like that. But
sure.
It's a really non-intrusive style, I think, as with Linklater. Again, as we said, he wanted to be as invisible as possible. But I don't think that that's like saying, because a lot of times with this sort of Sundance crowd, you think, well, they just had a handheld camera, shaky cam all the time, or they just plopped down the camera
No.
and went shot, reverse shot. He's constantly like probing with the camera, the camera movements, the framing, but it feels like all the zooms and the movements, they feel motivated by what's happening in the scene. And that's why it has that improvisational feel. And rather than like a pre-planned, like, the camera's going to move here and it's going to get right here on this emotional moment or something like that.
Which so has got to be tough to do with improvised dialogue and responses. And you catch that a little bit sometimes. They talk over each other a little bit. Or there's a weird edit out of a scene, like he wanted to capture one moment more and didn't like maybe what came after that. I don't know.
Yeah.
But it looks cool. Like, it's got a good look to it. I like the natural light. I like the 16 millimeterness of it. I like how it's tight on people, so it's not a big crowd, but it never feels forced, you know, in a way. It's Linklater does it better to me, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. This is like Whit Stillman. This is just like pointless to me. Like, I'm just watching dialogue happen again and again and again, and it does not, I don't think it progressed her. And I thought the ending was a fucking, that got me really mad, because I thought it was like a cop out.
how so? Yeah.
Because like, this person has rejected every offer of like actual human contact, except maybe she takes people up on things when they offer them to her and she'll accept it and then change her mind. And then all of a sudden it just happens. Like, she's just sitting there and someone walks up. Now maybe that's a chemistry thing, whatever. She just likes the look of a guy, but all of a sudden she's begging a guy to go on vacation with him. It just did and it's just to get you to that end bit that is set up, when she eavesdrops on the old people talking on the beach. And it was just such a okay, I watched this for this whole time, and now it just switches. I didn't find hope in that. I didn't find, like, you know, there is a reason to keep going or something like that. It does get better. I didn't find that. I found, like, okay, that's a cheat.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, I didn't feel it as like it gets better, kind of thing, because I feel like the whole film is about her searching for something and she can't really quite explain what. And I think like towards the end, she's starting to reveal herself a little more. She actually reveals more when she's around people she doesn't know as well, which is again a very like a shy person's kind of strange thing. It's the woman, the Swedish woman, who she's the most kind of open with about what her issues are. And she's actually talking about men, and she says, I want a man who's romantic. And then she's like, well, what do you mean by romantic? And then she's, do you mean this? No, I don't mean this. I mean romantic. But she can't really even explain that. Like, she's constantly searching for something, but doesn't know what she's searching for. You know what I mean? Like, and so I think it comes down to her finding something magical, finally something transcendent, finding something that's sort of, you know, larger and bigger. Now, the man, French Bill Hader, who she ends up hooking up with at the end, again, I think this comes down to just how sort of inscrutable the character is and how much she is throughout the whole thing. You know, like, she's constantly set up with, like, hey, why don't you do this? Here's a great thing that would happen. No, I don't want to do that. No, I don't want to do that. Or here, why don't you go here? No, then I'll go here and then I'll leave. It's just as inexplicable why she just connects with this guy. But she does, you know. Like, why is it this guy? It's not just that he's like good looking or just that he's forward or not forward or anything like that. There's just, I don't know. She maybe senses the romance in him, senses whatever she means by that, but she senses it in him, obviously. And it's funny because she even talks about how she's like, I haven't wanted to go with anybody. Anyone who comes up to me, I don't want to go. But she's being honest with him again in the way that when you first meet, the person you were meant to be with, you know, that first date where you have that heart to heart and you don't want to, like, you share things that you wouldn't share, you know, otherwise, about yourself when you find the person that you are meant to be with. So anyway, to me, it worked. It's kind of pointless, I think, for us to go through the plot of this movie, because as I said, there isn't really much of a plot. The first scene is her friend. She gets a call at work, and her friend says, I can't go to Greece. Well, she doesn't say. We just hear her say, you know, it's Bob Newhart. It's like, well, what? King Kong. Fuck. Huh. Rub the bananas on the Empire State.
I can remember the moment I realized. I was like, this is all he does. He just fakes conversations. Like, that's his whole stand-up routine.
But she finds out that her friend is canceling their plans. And then calls who we find out is her ex-boyfriend, you know, and this whole ex-boyfriend thing isn't really defined, but obviously it's, you know, she's not fully over it when the film starts. I mean, I think
she's still lying to people that she's with somebody.
She lies to a child.
Yeah.
She lies to them, they're having black currants, eating wild black currants. And she's just like, oh yeah, I got all these boyfriends, you know, I got a fiance, but then I got all these boyfriends, you know? And then when that Swedish girl says basically the same thing to her, she's like kind of aghast. She's like, what? Like, no, I would never, you know, and also lies to her, as well. But yeah, so she wants to go to Greece. Her ex-boyfriend's using this vacation home. And so, again, she goes to Cherbu. She's supposed to stay there and then leaves early. She makes it weird.
She cries 5 times.
She cries a whole lot. Yeah, there's the meat scene. She's really lonely. She's by herself a lot, right? Mm-hmm. Everyone goes out to do something and she goes for a walk by herself. Everyone's sitting here talking and she's sitting by herself. You know, she's just... she's not comfortable and she's not making anyone comfortable, and then suddenly departs. Her family wants her to go with them to Ireland, but she doesn't want to go to Ireland. She goes to the Alps and she's got a place to stay there. This was my favorite scene because she like gets there. It's the whole thing. Like, she goes to the Alps and she gets there. Oh, the key's not here yet. She goes to take a hike and then comes back. It's like, I'm leaving. It's just like I'm leaving. I'm out. Back to Paris and then to Biarritz. And that's where most of the second half of the film, and this is where it kind of, again, this is, I thought it was a really wonderful section of the film. Layers subtly pulled away, not obviously pulled away. Yeah, I don't know. It worked for me. And then the final scene they go to, it's Saint-Jean-de-Luz. And then that's the final scene where they see the Green Ray, although it was filmed at the Canary Islands.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go. And that's that. I think that's enough about the Green Ray. Anything you wanted to say before we banish this sucker to the land?
I'm fully in the minority. Like, I looked up what people had to say about it, and people like yourself, they extol the things that I didn't like. So it's really just, like you said, a Rubicon. I see this movie differently. Everything that I'm hearing as portrayed as a positive was, to me, just like left me cold.
Yeah. I mean, you're being consistent, though. Because, like I said, this is, you could have copy and pasted almost this whole argument from Vagabond, at least.
Vagabond, though, I will say I was way more interested in Vagabond.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
But your issues with it, a lot of it came down to not liking
spending time with that person,
the main character, and having to spend time with someone who is, yeah, again, a difficult person to spend time with. But it, like, and as I said, you are fully right that I'm not going to disagree that she's a difficult person to spend time with as a human, as a movie character. I definitely thought fascinating. But let's wrap this sucker up. Remind everybody about our ratings. If we both think that this was a sound selection by the Sight and Sound critics polled, then kaboom, right into the cannon fodder cannon it goes. If one or both of us think it was a wee bit slight, then uh-oh, no cannon. But we'll select a slighted movie, not in the Sight and Sound top 250, to put in its place. I, spoiler alert, am going fully sound. Corky, don't keep us waiting. Don't make me sit here crying.
Okay.
What do you got for
us? I'm going to go and just let everybody know I'm okay with spending time with difficult people. And it's not just women-centered movies that I don't like. Like, I feel bad because I look back and I'm like, okay, Mouchette's a little girl, but I didn't like that one. Wanda, I really didn't like. Samba Zanga, really? I didn't really like.
Difficult women. You got a real problem. You got a real problem with
Vagabond, yeah. This one. So I'm gonna scratch both those away. Difficult people and difficult women, but I'm gonna double it up. I'm gonna give you two choices here.
Okay.
And they're both fairly recent. That's why I'm going to. 2021's Joachim Trier movie, The Worst Person in the World. This is a difficult person who doesn't like to be anywhere they're in and is unhappy in every situation they seem they want and gets himself into worse situations. Sure. But a fucking fantastic movie, well told, beautifully shot, beautifully acted, and something I have watched like three times.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah. Great film. In that time. The other option I'm giving you for you to go along with is last season's TV show Pluribus, the story of a very unhappy person. The whole world wants to be alone or not with the public. They get their wish kind of granted to them without giving away too much of the TV show. And yet it's the worst thing that could happen to them. I mean, literally, yes, it would be the worst thing that could happen to anybody, but she is an unhappy person. Even when she has the opportunity to meet the other people, she hates everybody and fights with them. An angry person. But I spent 9 hours with that person. So
practically the same. Practically the same thing. No, those are very different types of films, certainly. Good picks, though. Excellent picks. Well, Pluribus, I'm going to just toss that aside because I did see Pluribus and liked it. Rhea Seehorn is amazing.
Yeah.
But it's a TV show, so no.
Sure.
I also reject
Twin Peaks. TV show was put on?
Twin Peaks, The Return is on in the Sight and Sound top 250. And again, there's nothing, I've seen some ballots where some person just put like Game of Thrones. Like just Game of Thrones, not like an episode or something. Like
I will
Game
kick that person in the
there's
nuts.
There's nothing stopping them from doing it. The only thing is like, here's 10. You get up to 10. That doesn't mean you have to put in 10. It doesn't mean you have to put in 10 movies.
Way. Like think of, know you. You've done this for 49 years. Mm. You have just compiled lists in your head of, and especially like your favorite movies. If you had that opportunity and you're sitting there like, you're going to waste it with fucking Game of Thrones? I put down, like,
The Office or something. Yeah. Yeah, right? Like, what a pointless thing. What a completely pointless thing. Yeah. But again, there's just nothing on this list. It's just 10. Here's a list of 10, and it can be whatever the hell you want, really. So I'll reject Pluribus out of hand. Really a big fan of Worst Person in the World, and also Sentimental Value, which is Joachim Trier's latest film. Great filmmaker. Love Renata Reinsva too, who's also in Sentimental Value. I'm just gonna say too recent for me.
Sure.
I need Valid. A certain amount of time. I go with the 10-year rule of I need at least 10, you know, because there's 10 years between these polls. I don't think anything in the last 10 years should come up. Interesting, you know, our old friend Paul Schrader, it's been like 40 episodes since I've made a Paul Schrader reference, but of course he fills out his Sight and Sound ballot every 10 years. And, you know, there's a little space where you can write something in there as well, if you want to. Some people do, some people don't. And he laid out his criteria for filling out his list. He says 25 years.
Holy
He's like,
shit.
No movie released in the last 25 years. He also is like one comedy, one Western or
that
one
I
he has
get.
Like certain parameters, and I think he says no one movie per director. You know, it could just be 10 Hitchcock films or 10 John Ford movies, but yeah. So he's got his own parameters too, but yeah, one of mine is I don't think it lasts 10 years. So call me in 5 years,
okay,
and we'll talk about Worst Person in the World. But you know what? Just sounds like fizzle. We are not going to have another entry into the Cannon Fodder canon. But you know what? That's okay, because it means that for another couple of weeks, we have 69 movies in the canon. Exactly. And that feels pretty good, as I think. Never mind.
That's what we thought about The Green Way. What did you think about The Green Way? I thought it was going to be a superhero movie. That just sounds like a superhero name.
Right.
Did you watch it with us? Had you seen it before? We'd love to hear your take on it. Leave us a comment on your favorite podcast app or contact us on Facebook and Instagram at Dare Daniel Pod. Tell us your thoughts.
All right. Well, now it's that time of the show where we will randomly select the film to review in 2 weeks on our next episode. You ready for this, Quirky?
Let's go, baby.
Here we go. Rootoot toot, Rooty toot, and toot, and the random number generator has brought something for us from Out of the Past. Yes, it's the film Out of the Past, the 1947 film starring Robert Mitchum, Kirk Douglas, Jane Greer, Rhonda Fleming. Directed by one of my favorites, Jacques Tourneur. I'm excited to talk about Tourneur in a couple of weeks. This is a film noir. I mean, this is like prototypical film noir. This is one of the all-time greats. Quirky, have you seen Out of the Past?
I've not seen it. I know of it because it always pops up on every noir list. If you're like, what noir movie should I watch? This pops up. I've had to stop myself from watching it.
Yeah, it's one of those, one of the top ones of the genre, absolutely. And it plays pretty well on the Sight and Sound list. And this will be two Robert Mitchum movies out of the last, what, 4 or 5 episodes? Because we did Night of the Hunter pretty recently as well. I'll read you the Letterbox synopsis. The peaceful life of a gas station owner is disrupted when a man from his past arrives in town and forces him to return to the dark world he had tried to escape. It's available to watch on Criterion Channel. It's also on HBO Max. If you're a subscriber, you can rent it on any of your favorite streaming apps. Plays on TCM a lot, probably like once a month, I would say, for the last, you know, 30 years or so. So not a super hard movie to find. It's only 97 minutes long, and if you've never seen it, it really is fantastic. It's been a while since I've seen it, so I'm excited to revisit. But if you've never seen it again, man, you are missing out. So give it a watch and come see us again in 2 weeks.
Until then, follow Dare Daniel Pod on Facebook and Instagram. Like and rate us on your favorite podcast app. If you'd like to donate to the show and be a titan, visit daredaniel.com. Find support the show in the menu or look for the donate button. If you're a fan of new movies, listen to Daniel review the top films of the day on Single Take with Daniel Barnes. For Cannon Fodder, I'm Corky McDonald.
And I'm Daniel Barnes. Until next time, save us a seat in the back row. Bye-bye.